Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, Barbie. Can I come to your house tonight?
Sure. I don't have anything big planned, just a giant blowout party with all the Barbies and planned choreography and a bespoke song. You should stop by.
So cool. You can find
me under the light. Well, however you may feel about what is arguably the world's most famous doll, there's no denying that the Barbie movie has become a cultural phenomenon this award season. There are beautiful people and flashy costumes. It's flashy and fun. But the blockbuster from Warner Brothers also attempts to take on some big topics like feminism, sexism, the patriarchy, and even climate change. Is that right, Anna Jane?
Yep. Barbie is one of the few films that acknowledges climate change in dialogue.
And you were especially looking out for any mention of that or a hint at climate change in this and other Oscar-nominated films. Can you tell us who you are and what you do?
My name is Anna Jane Joyner. It's an honor to be here. And I am the CEO and founder of Good Energy, which is a nonprofit creative support organization that works with TV and film writers on acknowledging and portraying climate change on screen.
And I'm Laura Lynch, and this is What on Earth, where we bring you a world of climate solutions. Today, those solutions include using cricket flour in Italian pizza and launching a methane-detecting satellite into space. But first, why portraying climate in pop culture matters, and how some of this year's Academy Award-nominated films could be considered winners when it comes to something called the Climate Reality Check. Anna Jane, welcome to What on Earth.
Thank you.
So first of all, tell us exactly what is the Climate Reality Check test?
Yes, so it was inspired by the Bechdel-Wallace test, which measures female representation on screen. That test is basically, are there two female characters who are named and who talk to each other about something other than a man? And it was created almost 40 years ago, the year I was born, actually. Alison Bechdel wrote it as a comic strip. It wasn't really supposed to be taken seriously. She was more using humor to comment on the lack of female representation in TV and film, but it got picked up and now it's ubiquitously used in the industry to measure female representation. And we wanted to create something that was also very simple, very incisive, a little bit playful. So that was the inspiration. And we worked with, we interviewed over 200 TV and film writers, creative executives, and comm strategists, and worked with an incredible research team and professor out of Colby College in Maine. We wanted to create a baseline test. So it was just like not commenting on the nature of the story, just does climate exist in this story? And does a character know it?
But who's the test for then? It's not just any old story, is it?
It's four stories that are set on Earth now or in the future. So no historicals or high fantasy, but it's taking place in the modern era on Earth.
And in this case, you only looked at feature films, not documentaries, not shorts, and you applied the test only to films, as you said, where the story takes place on Earth, and it's happening now or it's happening in the future. Why that criteria?
You know, high fantasy that takes place in other universes obviously is a different universe than the world that we are currently living in one. But stories that are grounded on this earth, you know, if these characters were real people, they would be encountering climate change if they lived today or in the future. And so that's really what the question asks is if this is a contemporary story, you know, does climate exist in the story in the same way that it exists in our real lives?
And your class of contestants this time around were films that were nominated for Oscars.
Yeah, so we wanted to actually apply it as we released it. So we worked with the professor and his students at Colby College and applied it to this year's Oscar nominees. There was only 13 of the scripted features that actually met the set on Earth, now or in the future criteria. And of those 13, three passed, which is about 23%.
Just before we get into those three films, one of the ones that wasn't considered for your test was Killers of the Flower Moon, even though it's largely about oil.
Yeah, and absolutely, we're not saying that we don't want other kinds of stories that grapple with, you know, related issues or that take place in the past, or even metaphors or analogies like Avatar that are, you know, our fantasy. We definitely want more of those stories. But the intention for this test and the work of Good Energy is really focused on grounding our lived experience of being human in the age of climate change and having that reflected in the stories that we watch.
And then the Killers of the Flower Moon was also set in the past, which means it didn't meet that criteria.
Which is the reason it didn't. Right. It didn't meet that criteria. Although a phenomenal film that I definitely want to see more films that speak to the dangers of fossil fuels and the injustices of it. So
yes, it was a very good film. So let's go back to the Barbie movie, which is one of the three. Where exactly in the film was there a reference to climate change?
Yeah, it was when Barbie goes from Barbie Land, travels to Earth, and she's looking for the little girl who's kind of affecting her by, you know, playing with her. And she thinks she's found her, and she finds her at a middle school and just walks up, you know, thinking that this little girl is going to revere her and she'll be welcomed. And the little girl goes off on her.
Look at yourself.
Wow. I am technically stereotypical Barbie.
You set the feminist movement back 50 years. You destroy girls' innate sense of worth, and you are killing the planet with your glorification of rampant consumerism.
No, I'm supposed to help you and make
you happy. Her name is Sasha. She's one of the main characters, and, you know, about a range of things related to body image and feminism and patriarchy. But she also talks about climate change and says, the quote is, you're killing the planet with your rampant consumerism, which, according to our criteria, passed the test.
The character isn't even explicitly talking about climate changes and warming temperatures or fossil fuel emissions, but about consumerism. And it's really a short reference. Do you think that the message still connects with the audience?
Well, we actually did wrestle with that because obviously consumerism and killing the planet could use, you know, could reference other things. But every movie was coded in two different settings by a different group of students. And the ones that we worked with just felt like there was no reasonable, you know, explanation for rampant consumerism is killing the planet in 2023 that isn't a reference to climate change. So it was really them as young people being like, there's nothing else this person could be speaking about if this is supposed to be taking place now. As far as our second part of the question about it being a quick mention, we want to see more stories that grapple and kind of directly with climate change, that center it as a more integral part of the story. However, having climate acknowledged in stories that have nothing to do with climate change as just a part of our world is also really critical. At some point, if your story is set, you know, on Earth now or in the future, and you don't acknowledge that climate change is a part of the world of those characters, then it's going to feel like flip phones. You know, it's just going to be so far outdated and removed from our lives that it won't feel relevant to audiences. Yeah. And for climate, it's really important that we normalize conversations about climate change. And one, you know, way that research has definitely shown is very effective at doing that is having it come up in television and film, especially with, you know, characters that we have a relationship and we really love.
So what other films passed the test?
It was Mission Impossible, also passed, and then NIAID were the two others that passed.
Can you give us a very quick reference to what made those two qualify?
So basically, one of the characters is talking to Tom Cruise's character, and he says the next world war isn't going to be a cold one. It's going to be a war over rapidly shrinking ecosystems, dwindling energy, drinkable water, and breathable air.
That's pretty explicit.
Yep.
And what about NIAID? I saw NIAID. It's a Netflix film. It's based on the true story of Diana NIAID, a real person trying to make this enormously long swim.
Listen to this.
Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
Don't you want to be... Where is the climate reference there?
Yep, it's when she gets stung by a box jellyfish, which is a very dangerous jellyfish that is not native to those waters. And the character that Jodie Foster plays, just basically says they're not supposed to be here. It's due to global warming. And she actually does even say the term global warming.
Okay. So three out of the films you were looking at, it doesn't sound like a lot. What did the results tell you about whether the topic of climate change is becoming more mainstream?
A few years ago, when we first started Good Energy, we worked with USC's Media Impact Project at the Norman Lear Center and looked at scripts that aired between 2016 and 2020, so over 37,000 scripts, at how often was climate being acknowledged. And it was only about 2.8% of the time. You know, to see the Oscars in 2024 have 23% of the films that pass that criteria, that is good progress for sure.
Well, I was going to ask you, is there one film from this or other years that you consider to be the best or really good when it comes to highlighting climate change?
Ooh, yeah, so many. One of my all-time favorite climate stories was one of the first ones, and it was Oscar nominated. It's Beasts of the Southern Wild. I'm from the Gulf Coast of Alabama. It's set on the Gulf Coast. It's a beautiful, just magical story, but it also talks about the connection of climate and racial injustice and economic inequality. So it really beautifully and magically and very entertainingly, kind of touches on these important elements of climate change. So Beasts of the Southern Wild is probably my favorite Oscar nominated one.
You know what? I love movies and I loved Beasts of the Southern Wild. I was mentioning it to my colleagues earlier in the day. So I'm with you on that one. What do those films tell you or inform you when you offer to help other storytellers who want to include climate in their narratives and do it without being heavy-handed or preachy?
Yeah, I mean, the way that we approach that is, one, you know, giving great examples of case studies that have done it in a really beautiful, creative way that feels very authentic to the story. Also highlighting, you know, that these stories can be very commercially successful and critically acclaimed. So that is a piece of it, just like making sure that people are seeing inspiration for how this is done in a way that isn't preachy or shoehorned. And even in the more kind of climate mentions, like Abbott Elementary, for example, incorporates climate mentions throughout all their seasons. And it's, you know, it's not a central focus of the story, but it is something that comes up as a part of the lives of the characters regularly.
Right. In that case, we're talking about a television series, not an Oscar-nominated film.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So, pulling case studies. But our central process that we work with writers is, you know, if your story was taking place in the real world, if these were real people, what would the authentic way that they would be encountering climate change in their lives? So if you're, you know, if your story is set in Los Angeles today, they would be experiencing crazy heat waves and atmospheric rivers and wildfires getting worse. And so that would be a piece. But also they might, you know, climate solutions might be showing up organically because a lot of people in LA drive EVs or have solar panels. So just thinking about like what actually feels very natural to these characters is how we kind of start to really explore how, you know, climate shows up in a story that does feel very creative and authentic.
And finally, Anna Jane, but and most fundamentally, why is it so important that our climate reality is reflected more and more on screen?
I mean, there has not been a social movement in history where Hollywood didn't play a big role. I mean, everything from seatbelts to drunk driving to marriage equality to, all kinds of immigration storylines. And so Hollywood is the great storytelling engine of our time, and stories are very, very critical for being human and figuring out how to find courage and creativity when wrestling with some of these really big issues like climate change. So it's really important that we just normalize climate as a part of our lives and face it, because we can't do something about something that we're not talking about and looking at. It was also selfish in a lot of ways for starting Good Energy. And that's because I've worked on climate for 20 years, and I have experienced a lot of climate anxiety and grief and fear, and I live on the Gulf Coast, so it's been experiencing really horrible climate impacts and worsening storms. And I need these stories. Stories are where I go to find courage and solidarity and feel seen. And without climate being acknowledged in our stories, that's a really important missing piece for exploring and figuring out what it means to be human in the age of climate change.
Well said, Anna Jane Joyner. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me and sharing our story.
LD is go for launch.
And there's that go for launch from our launch director. So with that, all systems are go for Falcon 9's launch of the Transporter 10 mission.
The weather on the California coast at Vandenberg Space Force Base is perfect. On the pad, there's a rocket ready to go. It's filled with fuel, and it's about to blast into space with a special payload, one that people have been waiting years to see deployed in the name of fighting climate change.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ignition, and liftoff Falcon 9. Go SpaceX, go Transporter 10.
And as it streams into the atmosphere, you can hear cheer going up. And Jeff Privette, you were smiling too. In fact, you were there.
I was there, and it was one of the most exciting moments of my life, perhaps.
Jeff is the chief of the Climate Sciences and Services Division at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the United States. It's also known as NOAA. And he was so excited, he took a selfie. You look so happy with the rocket behind you.
I'll tell you, my other launches, I used to be with NASA and went to a number of NASA launches. Number one, they were all at night. Number two, they were by these big aerospace giant industrial contractors like Lockheed Martin. And this was exactly the opposite. This was not governmental, not giant industry. And it was in the daytime, and it just had this very sort of organic, exciting feel by a bunch of people who proposed what at the time was a preposterous idea, and they succeeded.
So you're probably wondering, what was this crunchy granola space shot that has this former NASA guy so pumped? The rocket was launched just days ago, and it was sending a new satellite into space. It's called MethaneSat, and it has one mission. But why don't I let Jeff tell us what that is? Jeff?
Hi, that mission is to basically be looking over all of the oil and gas basins of the world and to be detecting and measuring how much methane is being emitted from these various places by oil and gas facilities and particularly rigs, oil and gas rigs.
Why is this mission important? I mean, aren't there already satellites that are tracking methane?
There are, but not at this resolution. This satellite is unique for many different reasons, but in particularly trying to understand sort of as a collection of oil and gas rigs in these concentrated areas, how much methane is coming up. What we're talking about here is not natural emissions, but rather leaks, plumes coming from leaks, some known and some unknown by the oil and gas rigs. And the neat thing here is that by detecting these and reporting these to the individual companies, then they can go in there and cap these things. And the oil and gas industry has shown an ability to move from a leak down to zero emissions and continue operations. So it's something that we can really do that's very tangible that will make a real difference in slowing down climate change.
And we'll get into that a bit more. But first, I wonder if you could tell people, why is it important to know just how much methane is being emitted?
Yeah, that's a great question. We always think about carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as the most important heat-trapping gas. And one could argue over the very long time, as in many decades, that's true. However, surprisingly to many people, methane is a much more powerful greenhouse gas. It can trap heat at about 80 times the amount carbon dioxide does over a 20-year period. So it doesn't last in the atmosphere as long. However, when it's up there, it's doing much more damage.
Okay, you said there's lots of things that set this mission apart. It's also different because of who sponsored the mission. Can you tell me more about that?
Exactly. So this was sponsored by the Environmental Defense Fund, which is a nonprofit, and they had the idea, and they went out and got funding. They partner with many different organizations, and one of the key organizations being the New Zealand government. But there are many partners in this, and I believe it's unprecedented that a nonprofit organization has put a satellite in space.
Oh, that's interesting. And we know the Canadian government is saying it's monitoring the satellite, but it isn't yet certain whether it will consider the data useful. I'm wondering where you stand on the use of methane sats information.
My organization is taking very much the same approach as the Canadian government is, which is a little bit of a optimistic wait and see. We're going to, obviously, when the data comes down, start to look at it and compare it with what we're measuring through other sources and in situ measurements, and see how it could and would fit into our portfolio.
You've laid out how this information is important for oil and gas companies, environmental groups, governments, but why should listeners care that this satellite is in space tracking methane?
Listeners should be excited because we always get negative news about greenhouse gases and warming and climate change, and that's very real. And once you start that train going down the line, it's very hard to stop it. Very, very hard. And I'm part of this, right? As a human being with kids, I don't want them to be inheriting a world that's changed so much from the world that we know and enjoy. And this is something that can very tangibly slow things down. It's not going to stop it, but by simply slowing down the rate of change, whatever those changes are going to be in the world, it allows other things to catch up. We can get better mitigation approaches. We can do better adaptation, build resilience into everything from our economies, our infrastructure, just all kinds of societal places where if there's fast change, we can't react and the impacts are much more severe. By slowing this down some, it will make all societies better able to adapt to climate change and hopefully ultimately give us time to be innovative and come up with discoveries which will allow us to finally reverse climate change. It will take a very long time and it might be different energy sources. I don't know what that's going to look like, but this buys us some time and that's the great value here.
It also does depend to a degree, doesn't it, on the good faith of the oil and gas companies actually taking action if it shows they're leaking methane.
It does, and I've got to acknowledge I don't know all the regulatory pieces that are in place.
Fair enough.
States can have different regulatory things, governments, and worldwide. But we do know other countries that we don't normally partner with in so many areas have taken great interest in this, and everybody wants to do something here. And probably part of it is regulatory, and part of it is good faith. Oil and gas executives have children and grandchildren too, and I think everybody is interested in slowing things down.
What about the emissions of sending the rocket into space? Will the information collected justify the fuel that was burned?
And flying out to watch the launch?
Yeah, that too, Jeff.
Fair point. It's funny. We shared a beer and talked about this that evening. You don't get anything for free, right? There are always trades and you end up trying to do more good than bad every day and every year of your life. And so it was a great event, but yeah, there's a lot of nasty things involved in the chemistry of rocketry and every other part of the development of such a satellite. But in this case, I think the good will far, far outweigh the bad.
So you paid your own way to the launch, as we said. I saw that you took a selfie there with the rocket going off behind you. Why was this one so special to you?
This one, for so many reasons, it was unique and special. One, of course, is what I spoke to before, that this is a nonprofit that was sponsoring this. It was just exciting being in the room around so many people who never, ever thought that they would be in some way involved in a rocket launch and a satellite. These are people who are, in some cases, environmentalists and who are just joining EDF to try to do good. Part of it was sort of the diversity of different organizations and contributors, from some of the venture capitalists and philanthropic people who help make this a reality to, for instance, BAE, Ball Aerospace, that has done this many times and are real experts in the field. Also, sort of the significance of not just the nonprofit world getting involved, but doing this on something so critically important as climate change, and particularly the methane problem, and knowing that if everything goes as planned, this will actually start the slowing down of climate change. And we've just all been waiting for those words to be said, like, we found something that can slow this train down a little bit. And that was very powerful.
Jeff Prevett will be watching what the new satellite discovers, as you will, I'm sure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Paper or plastic?
Oh, I forgot my own bags. Plastic. No, wait, paper. Hang on, which one's better? I don't know.
Don't stress, Neil. The podcast Living Planet is here to help. We know you want to do what's right for the planet, but you're busy and you have to make 1,000 small decisions every day. So we endeavor to answer, what's better?
Cotton or polyester?
Tea or coffee?
For answers to these environmental conundrums and your questions, subscribe to Living Planet wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Laura Lynch, and you're listening to What on Earth, where we bring you a world of climate solutions, and sometimes we find them in an Italian kitchen.
Non so, sembrerebbe anche un pochino più elastica, più maneggevole. È un valore aggiunto.
And what you're hearing there is an Italian chef kneading some pizza dough, but it's not just any pizza dough.
Okay, here's my first sampling of pizza made with cricket flour.
The first. The first pizza.
Wow. It's kind of hard to describe, but it's good.
Okay. Megan, did I hear that correctly? Pizza dough made with crickets?
You did indeed. Not long ago, a Neapolitan pizza maker introduced the dreaded pineapple pizza into Italy, and now it's a cricket flour pizza. This one made by Rome pizza maker Carlo Del Buono.
Okay, that doesn't sound like a typical Italian recipe. It doesn't even sound like a typical pizza recipe. What did it taste like?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I'd use the Italian word salmastra to describe it, which it's kind of like briny. It has a kind of a sea salty taste to it, but it also has a nutty taste. When I was talking with the chef, we both agreed it tastes a bit like pistachio, hazelnuts, a little note of anchovies. I mean, all tastes that you recognize, but the combination of these tastes together is new.
Okay, we'll get to why we're doing pizza reviews on a climate show. But first, I should probably let listeners know who you are. Megan Williams is CBC's Italy correspondent. Welcome back, Megan.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
So, Megan, what led you to that pizza kitchen?
Well, it all started with a brave new food producer that is going where no Italian food company has gone before, which is making this cricket flour for human consumption. Just over a year ago, the European Union authorized the adoption of powdered domestic crickets, and Italy approved the sale of that product about a year later.
Now, I have never knowingly eaten any crickets. but I have seen before that the crickets insects are high in protein and therefore more sustainable than meat production.
That's right. They're really high in protein. And this startup is hoping that Italians will soon integrate the product as basically a protein supplement. They want, they're hoping Italians are going to add it to everything from desserts to pasta and to pizza. Which is not going to be easy in you know, a country that adheres so closely to culinary traditions. I mean, the idea of mixing insects into sort of traditional products is extremely political in Italy.
Yeah, food as political. I get it. I want to dig into that controversy. But first, tell me some more about the company that's taking a big bet on crickets.
Well, it's a small company. It's essentially a startup. It's called Nutrinsect. It's in central Italy, a region called Le Marche, near a town called Monte Cassiano. So I visited their production site, and that sound that you're hearing is in one of the rooms. They have these like five or six really hot, humid rooms that have that slight kind of briny smell. And they're lined with bins, absolutely brimming with crickets. They're swarming around on these cardboard egg cartons that serve as their nest. And that is the co-founder, Jose Chani, explaining that the trill that we're hearing is actually the mating call of 45-day-old male crickets.
So they bury their eggs under the ground. You can kind of see there. They're burying them. And they do this for 15, 20 days?
And then the crickets are killed after about 30 days. Their temperature is gently lowered, so they're kind of lulled into sleep until they die, and then they're ground into powder.
It is a very, very delicate insect. The conditions, temperature, and humidity have to be precise, and you cannot overcrowd them. If one thing is off, they can all die, which is why so few companies have launched. Respect for their well-being is essential.
Devi rispettare assolutamente il benessere animale.
Well-being of crickets, I don't think I've ever heard that raised before. So they're not easy to be able to raise, but they're full of protein. So can you tell me some more about the environmental impact?
Well, I spoke with the senior food safety officer at the UN Food and Agricultural Organization here in Rome, who's an edible insect expert, Marcus Lipp. And he told me it's a very environmentally sustainable way of producing protein compared to where we usually get most of our protein, which is meat. Peer-reviewed studies have found greenhouse gas emissions by insects are way, way lower, you know, like 10 to 100 times lower than the amount of CO2 livestock produce per kilogram of protein. But Marcus Lipp said we need to be cautious about the numbers.
Why?
Well, because producing insects at an industrial level really hasn't taken off yet, and it's very difficult to have a firm grasp of what that will look like in terms of sustainability when it's like huge. You know, is the plant powered by renewable energy? Is the feed for the animals sustainably sourced? Does the waste cause environmental or climate problems?
Well, do all of those factors actually make or could make insect farming as polluting as livestock farming?
No. I mean, he was very clear in the study show that insect farming is hands down more sustainable. But all farming has climate and environmental impacts, and they need to be measured precisely and made public as the industry expands. This cricket farm that, you know, I visited in Le Marche wants to, you know, up production, as I mentioned, tenfold by the end of the year. So it's not quite sure what that's going to mean in terms of environmental impact.
Right. That expansion does reflect, though, a real optimism that Italy is ready for cricket powder, is it?
Well, the jury is out on that. I mean, Italy's current right-wing government has been very reluctant, let's say, to embrace insect products. After the EU approved some edible insects about a year ago, Italy's agricultural minister resisted green lighting the sale of the cricket powder here, saying that it contaminated Italian food traditions. When they finally did approve it, they imposed really strict regulations on supermarket placement, like it can't be near traditional flour, and labeling as well. In Italian, it's called polvere di grilli, which translates as cricket dust or powder, as opposed to flour, so that people wouldn't be confused that it was wheat flour. You know, there was all sorts of fake news about bakeries being mandated to use cricket flours. And, you know, some members of far-right parties like the League Party have tried to get cricket powder banned in school cafeterias. And And then recently here in Italy, there have also been farmers, you know, the farmers protesting on tractors against environmental regulations, including in their list of complaints, the emergence of insect-based agriculture.
Italy. Some farmers and right-wing politicians aren't too happy. What about the average Italian?
Well, a recent survey by the National Agricultural Association here, Coldiretti, found that over half of Italians strongly oppose eating insects, and that only about 1 in 6 are open to the idea of trying them. But Jose Chani says that, you know, for him and his company, that's enough Italians to get the industry going.
How are the initial sales?
Well, Nutrinsec doesn't yet produce much cricket flour, but what they have produced, they've sold, they say, for months to come, mostly orders from chefs who are keen to experiment with it, like Carlo Del Bono, who made that cricket pizza. He said it would be a great vegetarian pizza, you know, combining the sweetness of the tomato sauce, combining with that nutty, briny crust taste.
Perché buona, oggettivamente buona.
I'm going to put it on my menu and promote it among my regular clients for the simple reason that it is very good. I'm sure there'll be some laughter about it at first, but I think I'll call it the protein pizza because that's an aspect of it that will interest people to try it.
Yeah, maybe I could be attracted to it by that idea of eating more protein. Are there others who are experimenting?
Yes, there's a well-known Italian chef, Guido Mori, who runs the University of Italian Cuisine in Florence, and he's been a big promoter of insects as a protein alternative to meat. Here he is serving up some bamboo worms and crickets and scorpions at an aperitivo, recently at the Foreign Press Club in Rome.
Okay, I'm getting chills down my spine. Megan, did you sample all of those bugs?
I did. I mean, I've eaten these bugs before in Asia, but I have to say crickets are actually my favorite because they're dry and crunchy, and they kind of taste like potato chips.
But what about when you get the legs caught in between your teeth?
Well, you don't. They're pretty compact. I mean, the scorpions, I have to say, like, that was a whole other level of experimentation. But Mori has really little patience with the argument that the current Italian government is making about insects betraying Italian cuisine, because he says, you know, Italian cuisine has always been based on continuous innovation. He says Italians really have to rethink the kind of meat they eat and how often.
Eating meat should be an experience that connects to a cultural memory of well-being, not a low-cost, enormously polluting product we consume continuously and mindlessly. I love meat, but it must be high quality and produced sustainably and once a month. We have to be open to the alternatives.
Ma anche studiare le alternative che ci sono e le nuove possibilità.
Well, I guess that's it, isn't it? We need to find ways to feed the world's growing population without destroying the planet.
Yeah, and I think it should be something that we're all thinking about, not just with insects, but all sorts of non-meat protein sources. Here's Marcus Lipp from the UN again.
We are facing a challenge today. Feeding the world population and actually making sure that nobody will be hungry, we need creative approaches.
Megan Williams, thank you.
Thanks so much, Laura.
So here's the thing. You heard the chef there talk about the fact that it would be great on a vegetarian pizza with some tomato sauce, but hey, crickets... They don't think they qualify as vegetarian. I am a pescatarian, so I have to ask myself whether I could eat bugs. I'll have to think about that. But here's the problem. I really love pizza. And the way Megan described it, it sounded like it tasted pretty good. So let me get back to you on that. I'm going to think about this, and I'll let you know what I decide. There's plenty of worry after a Quebec lender declared it will no longer offer mortgages in some high-risk flood zones. Desjardins Group said in a statement the risk is too high to give new mortgages in those areas as the effects of climate change lead to increased damage.
The financial institution already refuses flood insurance in those areas.
Those omens about, you know, it's going to be harder to get a mortgage for high-risk homes. You know, if this is the thin edge of the wedge, then that's starting to happen.
That's Glenn McGilvery with the Institute for Catastrophic Loss Reduction. He says this is a significant move and could be the beginning of other banks following suit. And that could affect people like Tanya Caro. She's a resident of Pierrefonds Roxborough, a Montreal neighborhood. She lives on a 20-year floodplain, which means there's a 5% risk of flooding in any given year. It's the kind of area that Desjardins is worried about. In 2017, the Rivière des Prairies overflowed and flooded her home.
It was hell for everybody, to tell you the truth. We were woken up in the middle of the night by the firefighters, and we were rushed out. The water was just flooding all the streets. Downstairs, the basement was completely flooded. Everything, a full loss.
The mayor of Pierrefonds-Roxborough says that if other institutions decide to follow in Desjardins' footsteps, it could lead to huge losses for residents. Here's Jim Bass.
Well, there's incredible concern, you can imagine, because for them, yes, they don't want to leave. Now, if they choose or have to leave, they're worried that they're not going to get their money's worth. And so, aside from the folks wanting to purchase within these zones, not able to obtain their mortgages, you have the human aspect of the folks that are living there already, that have been there probably for many decades, that wouldn't want to leave. And if they leave, even if they wanted to downsize, how can they go anywhere if they don't get the market value from their home, something that they've lived and worked towards all their life?
Tanya shares the concern. Although her mortgage isn't with Desjardins, she doesn't know if she'll be able to remortgage her house for renovations now. And she'd been counting on downsizing one day to help her kids buy their first home.
It's kind of scary because, you know, with everything that's going on in the world, and like we talk about, you know, climate change, and then, you know, I know personally my kids will not be able to afford a house. They're renting. So to what extent, you know, if I do decide in the future to sell my house, what's going to be the chances that I'll be able to get what it's worth at that time? Will it be worth? Is that going to then, you know, downgrade the selling price? So it is a concern.
Glenn says as painful as this may be for people who are affected by the decision, he hopes the Desjardins announcement will at least lead to government action.
There's been talk of a national flood insurance program for quite some time now. This would be a federally run insurance solution for those 10% of homeowners that can't get flood insurance because they're too high risk. You get into things like flood defense, so the construction of flood defense infrastructure to protect homes and protect neighborhoods and things like that. You might right now be one of those 10% of homeowners that can't get flood insurance, but if infrastructure was built to protect a community, that might change.
In last year's budget, the federal government did set aside $32 million for the National Flood Insurance Program. Glenn also says that Ottawa should bring in mandatory buyback programs to pay homeowners the market value for their houses, allowing residents to relocate somewhere safer. We actually hear a lot from listeners about electric vehicles, including one recent email about hybrid cars. So what on earth, Rachel Sanders set out to answer it.
The race to electrify transportation in Canada is leaving a lot of people with a lot of questions. Martha Lane has one about hybrid cars. She bought a hybrid about 5 years ago. You know, the kind that use gas and your brakes to charge a battery that powers the motor. And Martha loves it. She asked us whether getting more hybrids on the road would help reduce fossil fuel use while we wait for more EV charging infrastructure to be built. So I went looking for some answers.
Traditional hybrid vehicles, as they're called, at the tailpipe, you're still producing significant emissions.
That's Mina Bibra from Clean Energy Canada. Mina points out that transportation is the second largest emitting sector in Canada. And when it comes to those so-called traditional hybrid vehicles,
they really don't cut it when it comes to those emissions benefits we need to be seeing compared to 80% reduction from a battery electric vehicle, because you're still using gasoline to drive that vehicle. So the majority of the emissions are still there.
Kara Clareman agrees. She's with a nonprofit called Plug and Drive. She says traditional hybrids do improve fuel efficiency, but there's another kind of hybrid picking up speed these days, and they do a better job of reducing emissions. They're called plug-in hybrids.
I think if you're ready to go to a hybrid, the benefits are so much more significant if you go to a plug-in that we sort of encourage people to go that extra step.
Plug-in hybrids have bigger batteries than traditional hybrids, and they also have an internal combustion engine. They can run for a certain number of kilometers on battery power alone. When the battery's drained, they work like traditional hybrids. So, if you plug them in regularly and use the battery as much as possible, that lowers their emissions.
So a plug-in obviously plugs into electricity. And our electricity, let's take Ontario where I'm located, is about 90% greenhouse gas free. So by using electricity instead of gas, you're going to drop your emissions by about 90%.
Plug-in hybrids aren't new, but there are more of them these days, and the Canadian government would like to see more of them on the road. Environment Minister Stephen Guilbeault says Canadians want to buy
electric vehicles, and unfortunately, they can't. There's a long waiting list, 6 months to almost 2 years for certain models.
That's why his government is proposing something called the Electric Vehicle Availability Standard. It's meant to give Canadians more access to affordable zero-emissions vehicles. Mina Bibra explains.
They would require automakers to make available for sale an increasing percentage of electric vehicles starting in 2026 and then going all the way out to 2035, where 100% of those sales would need to be an electric vehicle.
The list of zero-emission vehicles in the proposed regulation does not include traditional hybrid cars. So, what is on the list? There are fully battery-powered electric vehicles, of course, or BEVs, and vehicles that operate using hydrogen, and the list also includes plug-in hybrids, as long as they can run a certain number of kilometers on battery power alone. So, the federal government wants all new cars on the market to be zero emissions by 2035. But how do we get there?
They got to bring those prices down.
That's Joe McCabe, the president of Auto Forecast Solutions. It's a U.S. company that predicts what's going to happen in auto markets around the world. Right now, Joe says around 10% of vehicles sold in North America are fully electric, but he's expecting that number to stay flat for the next 3 years.
Until we get over these major hurdles of cost and infrastructure, there's still a major problem out there to really get the full mass adoption.
So Joe sees car manufacturers betting on hybrids as a way to draw people into the electric car market.
If I can convince you to buy a hybrid today, I've increased my chance of having you buy a BEV as your next vehicle.
Mina Bibra thinks the federal government's proposed EV sales rules will help with the cost of those cars as well.
An EV availability standard would actually help to drive down the costs of EVs even further and ensure that car makers are making good on their promises to deliver more affordable options to mainstream buyers.
She says there are more policies that could make zero emissions vehicles more affordable and speed up their adoption as well, such as rebates for used electric vehicles, more provincial rebates across Canada, and more accessible charging infrastructure.
When you have access to a private parking space at home, for example, you can just go in and charge your vehicle in your garage. But there are Canadians who do live in apartment buildings or in rural and Indigenous and other underserved areas. And so thinking about how we can build our charging infrastructure in those underserved areas.
So from more chargers to plug-in hybrids to government policy, there are a lot of pieces to the puzzle of getting greenhouse gases out of transportation in Canada. For What on Earth? I'm Rachel Sanders.
Lots to consider, lots of options. Rachel's here with me now in studio to read some more of your emails about EVs. Hi, Rachel.
Hey, Laura. Yes, we got a lot of emails, and a few of them are about not buying EVs. For example, we heard from two listeners with concerns about the mining associated with electric vehicle batteries.
Right, so-called critical minerals, and we've done stories about that in the past, and I know we're going to do more in the future.
That's right, we are. Christy Belcour wrote to say that she bought a hybrid, thinking it was the most environmentally responsible thing to do. But she said, quote, "That was before I started to become aware of the very high human cost of cobalt mining in Congo, where stories are emerging of horrific human rights abuses, forced child enslavement and labor, torture, death, and unbelievable working and living conditions. Had I known what the unseen costs were to the production of the batteries needed in EVs, I wouldn't have purchased the vehicle." Christie says, in our quest for, quote, green solutions, we cannot ignore human rights. Both go hand in hand.
And she's right about that. That is where a lot of the tension comes from in the quest to find these so-called green solutions. But I should say there are new regulations in the European Union around recycling the minerals from EV batteries.
That's true. And there's a lot more work to do in that area. David Schwab wrote to say that he believes when it comes to fighting climate change, electric cars offer a somewhat false promise. He said there's a climate impact to battery manufacturing, and he says the climate-friendly choice is to not buy a car at all. He writes, "As someone who has lived car-free for the majority of my adult life, I can confidently say that freedom is not owning a car. The extra money that I keep in my pocket goes a long, long way. In addition to this, I have a longer life expectancy than someone who drives every day. I have more face-to-face interactions with my fellow community members. The list goes on." And David also said, "When my car broke down and I was forced to take my bike every day, I felt my mood lift, my cardio system got stronger, and the cloud hanging over my head due to daily road rage evaporated."
That's
sounds
interesting.
Nice, right?
Yeah, I mean, no, the list sounds really interesting. And I know what he's saying because I didn't have a car for years until the pandemic. And I didn't have road rage other than when I was riding a bike and there were some people right. who didn't behave terribly kindly toward bikes. I might have got a little ragey then. Anyway, lots of benefits to living without a car, but that's not an option for everyone. I mean, able-bodied people who live in places with good public transport might be able to make it work, but there are a lot of valid reasons why some people need cars to get around.
That's very true. It depends on who you are and where you live. And that brings me to another email we got. Barb Hunt wrote to say that she owned an electric car for 2 years when she lived on Vancouver Island, and she loved it. She actually wrote us a list of 13 reasons why, including that they're fun to drive, they have lower maintenance costs, no smell of gas fumes, and she said she felt like she was part of a supportive EV owner community.
Okay, definitely sounds like she loved it, but you said she used to own it, so why did she get rid of it?
Because she moved to Winnipeg, where she can use public transit.
Aha! Where you live makes a difference.
It sure does.
When it comes to the choice.
Yeah, and we're going to take a good look at public transportation on the show in a few weeks. There's actually a brand new report out that lays out how Canada could double public transit ridership by 2035. So we're going to dig into that and take a look also at where in the world has the best public transit.
I have ideas about that, but I'll keep them to myself for now. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Laura.
And you can always write to us about anything you hear on the show. In particular, we want to hear your stories about public transit this week. If you take it, why? If not, why not? And also, let me know, what is the best public transit system you've ever been on and why? Write to us, earth@cbc.ca. Time now for some other climate stories in the news this week. It seems it could be the end of an epoch that never officially started. A group of earth scientists has voted down a proposal to declare a new era in geological time called the Anthropocene. A working group had found evidence that the new epoch started in 1950. That's when they say human impact on the planet accelerated. The factors back then included plastics and black carbon from fossil fuel consumption. It's not clear whether the issue will come back for more debate or another vote. In the meantime, we're still officially living in the Holocene, an epoch that began after the end of the last ice age, a mere 11,700 years ago. A California man has become the first person in the United States to be charged with trying to smuggle greenhouse gases into the country. Michael Hart is accused of buying coolants in Mexico for outdated refrigerators and air conditioning units, then concealing them in his car under a tarp at the border. He then posted them online and sold them for a profit. He has pleaded not guilty. The gases, hydrofluorocarbons, are being phased out in most countries because they can warm the planet much more than carbon dioxide.
The U.S. banned the importation of HFCs in 2020. And of course, you can read more about climate change in the CBC What on Earth newsletter. You can subscribe to have it delivered to your inbox every week. Remember, you can listen to all of our episodes on demand at CBC Listen, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, leave us a review because we read them. That's all for us this week. The show was put together by Missy Johnson, Vivian Luck, Rachel Sanders, Molly Siegel, Matthias Wolfson, and Catherine Rolfson. Special thanks this week to Jill English, Allison Northcott, Paolo Pietropaolo, and Steve Zhang. I'm Laura Lynch. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.